Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Vietnam War draft dodger Donald Trump once more stomps upon the world stage as a Napoleonic imitator, demanding U.S. seizure of Canada, Greenland, and the Panama Canal, also insisting the Gulf of Mexico be renamed the Gulf of America, presumably with a K. Trump's less than esteemed paternal lineage traces back to an Alaskan gold rush whorehouse pimp whose capitalistic sense of supply and demand initiated the family fortune, but certainly did not provide any trace of nobility in its succession. Trump is attempting to impose upon American citizenry that unless anyone can absolutely prove they are native born, which is also a sudden controversy of citizenship, or are documented citizens of the USA, the purge of non-citizens under Trump's reign will most likely be ruthless and unsparing, which will make the USA feel like Nazi Germany under Hitlerian intolerance, especially when questioned about the purpose of this inquisition and the unnecessary chill it imposes upon American rights to freedom from legalistic harassment and punitive legalities, not to mention ethnic prejudices. I start today's program with a couple of articles from the Guardian newspaper. The first, what is birthright citizenship and what does Trump's executive order do? And it's by Alexandra Villarreal. With a slug, Trump signed an order trying to end the right to citizenship for some children born in the U.S. As part of a sweeping crackdown on both undocumented and legal immigrants, Donald Trump signed an executive order trying to end the right to citizenship for some children born in the United States. In a country where birthright citizenship, regardless of lineage, is a deeply held value, the president's attempt to cut off that right for future generations could create a permanent underclass through policy change that would specifically target communities of color. His executive order faces court challenges from civil rights organizations, which have favorable constitutional language and over a century of legal precedent on their side. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, late last Monday, led a group of organizations in filing a lawsuit challenging Trump's order. Here is more on the right to birthright citizenship and its future under the Trump administration. What is birthright citizenship? When Trump and his allies reference birthright citizenship, they are usually alluding to the legal principle of jus soli, which I hope I'm saying correctly, which means right of the soil, quote unquote, in Latin. Put simply, it allows nearly everyone born on U.S. soil to become a U.S. citizen. What is the legal basis for birthright citizenship in the U.S.? As a concept, jus soli comes from English common law, which held centuries ago that people born in England were natural subjects. But unrestricted birthright citizenship in the United States that includes people of color, not just white Americans, derives from the U.S. Constitution. In 1857, the Supreme Court ruled that black descendants of enslaved people could not be U.S. citizens. To right this injustice, just over a decade later, and after the Civil War, the U.S. ratified the 14th Amendment. The first line of the 14th Amendment reads, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, quote, unquote. Known as the Citizenship Clause, this phrase, alongside a number of related statutes and regulations, establishes the modern basis for birthright citizenship. What have U.S. courts said about birthright citizenship for the children of immigrants? Even as the 14th Amendment was ratified, Americans were starting to turn against immigrants in the United States, especially Chinese workers. Soon, Congress had enacted legislation to heavily restrict further Chinese migration and make life difficult for those already stateside. Wong Kim Ark, a young man born in San Francisco to immigrant parents, went to China to see his family. When he tried to return home to the United States, he was not allowed into the country based on allegations that he was not a U.S. citizen. But the Supreme Court saw the situation differently. In an 1898 precedential decision that has withstood the test of time, the justices ruled in favor of Wong Kim Ark's U.S. citizenship claim, even though his parents were Chinese immigrants unable to naturalize. Who is not a U.S. citizen, even if they are born in the U.S.? There are exceedingly rare exceptions to the principle of jus soli, where people born in the U.S. are not automatically granted U.S. citizenship. Until the enactment of a law in 1924, indigenous peoples born in the U.S. were excluded. In 2021, the Supreme Court decided that people born in American Samoa's unincorporated territories are not automatically guaranteed birthright citizenship unless Congress enacts legislation. And the children of foreign diplomats, or in a more violent scenario, the kids of enemy occupiers, also lack a right to U.S. citizenship by birth. Do other countries have birthright citizenship, like in the United States? In comments criticizing the U.S.'s version of birthright citizenship, Donald Trump has said, "We have to end it. We are the only country that has it," quote, unquote. In fact, dozens of countries have a right to citizenship based on place of birth. Like the United States, most of these countries are within the Western Hemisphere, including Canada and Mexico. That said, birthright citizenship is less common in other regions of the world. What does Trump's executive order do? The executive order signed this past Monday tries to make it so that children born in the United States, but without at least one parent who is a lawful permanent resident or U.S. citizen, are no longer automatically extended U.S. citizenship. It also disallows federal agencies from issuing or recognizing documentation proving U.S. citizenship for such children. Notably, the executive order targets kids born to both unauthorized immigrants and people legally in the U.S. on temporary visas. Could Trump actually end birthright citizenship? Maybe, although probably not, and almost definitely not through executive order. The Citizenship Clause is part of the United States Constitution, the nation's founding document. Generally, legal scholars strongly suggest that neither executive action nor legislation should be able to supersede the Constitution's guarantee of birthright citizenship for those born on U.S. soil. However, because the legal precedent set by Wong Kim Ark well over a century ago is so fundamental to how birthright citizenship relates to the children of immigrants, a court battle erupting from Trump's executive order could, in the most extreme scenario, jeopardize the United States' understanding of birthright citizenship as we know it. In fact, forcing the Supreme Court to reinterpret the 14th Amendment is probably part of the long game that the Trump administration is playing with its executive order. Yet even with the White House raring for a fight, a complete overhaul of case law around birthright citizenship remains improbable. The other way to override an existing part of the Constitution would be to ratify another amendment, which would require a level of political support that is unlikely for such a fringe right-wing issue. How else could the Trump administration police birthright citizenship? Even if the administration is unable to completely undo birthright citizenship for the children of certain immigrants, officials have reportedly been exploring other ways to tackle the topic. For instance, they could try to restrict short-term visas for pregnant travelers so those travelers could not give birth in the U.S. And that was for the Guardian newspaper by Alexandria Villarreal. What is birthright citizenship, and what does Trump's executive order do? And now, again for the Guardian, by Hugo Lowell. Trump's return to the White House is a carefully choreographed display of brute force. With a slug, Trump's team has learned how to weaponize his power over the Republican Party to achieve their political goals. Donald Trump swept back into the presidency in a display of brute force power on Monday, seizing control of the optics of the inaugural ceremony and then the federal government before he signed a flurry of executive orders as his aides took over the West Wing. The return of Trump to office was choreographed on his terms and notably for television, after he announced in a Truth Social post, without telling anyone first, that he was moving the outdoor ceremony inside the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol because of the cold weather. The Congressional Planning Committee scrambled to accommodate Trump's wishes, and he was sworn in as the 47th Commander-in-Chief on a special stage that was surrounded by studio lights and guests that include the world's richest man, Elon Musk, and Meta's Mark Zuckerberg. The official part of the ceremony held at the seat of American democracy was streamed live at the venue for the unofficial part of the ceremony, the nearby Capital One Arena, a sports venue transformed by another specially constructed stage adorned with the presidential seal. It all made for a surreal scene, the real ceremony playing out on giant screens in the venue where a purely theatrical ceremony would take place later in the day. Hours after he was sworn in, Trump sat at a dark wooden table with its own presidential seal strategically set up directly across from a riser of around 100 television cameras to sign a series of executive orders in front of the crowd before he did the rest in the Oval Office. But as Trump basked in the theatrics of the transfer of power, his senior staff, with military efficiency, started their takeover of the executive branch, fanning across the White House complex to enter their offices in the West Wing and execute the contents of the orders. The orders Trump signed were numerous, and they were momentous, from issuing full pardons to about 1,500 people convicted of January 6th Capitol attack charges and commuted the sentences of Proud Boy and Oath Keeper extremists convicted of seditious conspiracy. He also signed an order directing the Justice Department to not enforce a federal law banning TikTok in the U.S. for 75 days, telling reporters during a freewheeling session in the Oval Office that he no longer thought TikTok was a national security threat because it was popular with kids, quote unquote, who voted for him. They started the process of radically reshaping the executive branch itself by removing protections for career employees as part of a wider effort to fire officials deemed to be part of the so-called deep state, or people seen as insufficiently loyal to him personally. And they literally remade the interior of the White House, ripping out the decor of Joe Biden's presidency in the Oval Office and replacing it with the starburst pattern carpet and gold curtains that Trump had during his first term. In the stairwell between the basement of the West Wing and the first floor, pictures of Trump were back in the gold frames. The execution of the second Trump administration is poised to be dramatically different compared with the first. For one, his team has learned how to manipulate the levers of government and weaponize Trump's power over the Republican Party to achieve their political goals. Trump feels unencumbered to bully his critics and do what he wants, according to close advisors. He feels carefree that he has no investigations hanging over him like he did in 2017, and he almost certainly will never be the target of a federal criminal case again. Part of the ruthless efficiency with which Trump is expected to move on his first days back as president is born from the knowledge that in his first term, aides and career officials would invariably delay implementing directives in the hope that Trump would forget and move on. Whether the West Wing will be less chaotic remains to be seen. In his first term, Trump cycled through four chiefs of staff as he either soured on their attempts to manage his most extreme impulses or they fell victim to internal backstabbing by aides jockeying for influence. The incoming White House Chief of Staff, Susie Wiles, is not anticipated to have that problem after she demonstrated remarkable staying power as his campaign manager by generally agreeing with Trump and quietly ejecting aides who threatened to upend her management. There will also be almost no officials who have greater allegiance to the institution of the presidency than to the president himself. Gone are the days of White House consuls such as Don McGahn, who cooperated with the Russia investigation for fear that Trump had obstructed justice. Still, the campaign was a smaller team compared to a full West Wing staff, and even then, tensions flared in the final months of the election cycle and through some of the transition as aides jockeyed for influence, one thing that is always constant in Trump world. And now, here we go again. Trump's Territorial Ambitions Rattle a Weary World by Damian Cave, who wrote this for the New York Times. When Donald J. Trump won a return to the White House, many countries thought they knew what to expect and how to prepare for what was coming. Diplomats in world capitals said they would zero in on what his administration does, rather than what Mr. Trump says. Bigger nations developed plans to soften or counter his threat of punitive tariffs. Smaller countries hoped they would simply hide from 4 more years of gale force America first. But it's getting harder for the world to keep calm and carry on. At Tuesday's news conference at Mar-a-Lago, Trump declined to rule out the use of force in a potential land grab for Greenland and the Panama Canal. He vowed to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. He also said he could use economic force to turn Canada into the 51st state as a matter of American national security. For those eager to parse substance from bluster, it looked like another performance of scattershot bravado. Trump 2, the sequel, more unrestrained. Even before taking office, Trump, with his surprising wish list, has stirred up "here we go again," quote-unquote, commentary from across the globe. Beyond the chatter, however, are serious stakes. As the world prepares for Trump's return, the parallels between his preoccupations and the distant age of American imperialism in the late 19th century are becoming more relevant. Trump has already championed the era for its protectionism, claiming that the United States in the 1890s, quote, was probably the wealthiest it ever was because it was a system of tariffs, unquote. Now he seems to be adding the focus from the 19th and early 20th centuries on territorial control. What both epochs share is a fear of shaky geopolitics and the threat of being locked out of territory with great economic and military importance. As Daniel Immerwahr, an American historian at Northwestern University, put it, we are seeing a reversion to a more grabby world. For Trump, China looms ready, in his view, to take territory far from its borders. He has falsely accused Beijing of controlling the American-built Panama Canal. There is also the specter, more grounded in reality, of China and its ally Russia moving to secure control over Arctic sea routes and precious minerals. At the same time, competition is increasing all around as some nations, India, Saudi Arabia, rise, and others, Venezuela, Syria, spiral and struggle, creating openings for outside influence. In the 1880s and 1890s, there was also a scramble for control and no single dominant nation. Countries became more powerful. They were expected to physically grow, and rivalries were redrawing maps and causing conflicts from Asia to the Caribbean. The United States mirrored Europe's colonial designs when it annexed Guam and Puerto Rico in 1898. But in larger countries, like the Philippines, the U.S. eventually chose indirect control by negotiating deals to advance preferential treatment for American businesses and its military interests. Some believe that Trump's fixation on Greenland, the Panama Canal, and even Canada is a one-man revival of the debate over expansionistic pursuits. This is part of a pattern of the U.S. exerting control or trying to over areas of the globe perceived to be American interests without having to summon up the dreaded words empire, colonies, or imperialism while still extracting material benefits, said Ian Tyrrell, a historian of American empire at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Trump's threats of territorial takeover may be simply a transactional starting point of some kind of personal wish. The United States already has a deal with Denmark that allows for base operations in Greenland. his suggestion of Americanization there and elsewhere amounts to what many foreign diplomats and scholars see as an escalation more than a break with the past. For years, the United States has been trying to curtail Chinese ambitions with the familiar playbook. The Philippines is again a focus with new deals for bases the American military can use in any potential war with Beijing. So are the sea routes that matter most for trade, both in Asia and around the Arctic, as climate change melts the ice and makes navigation easier. What the United States always wanted was access to markets, lines of communication, and capacity for forward projections of material power, Professor Tyrell said. But for some regions in particular, past as prologue inspires dread. Panama and its neighbors tend to see Trump's comments as a blend of both the 1890s and the 1980s, when the Cold War led Washington to meddle in many Latin American countries under the guise of fighting communism. The Monroe Doctrine, another 19th century creation that saw the United States treat the Western Hemisphere as its exclusive sphere of influence, has reemerged into relevance alongside tariffs and territorial deals. Carlos Hugue, a popular columnist in Mexico City, said Latin America was more worried about Trump's return than any other part of the world. This is Trump with majorities in both houses after 4 years complaining, a guy that only cares about himself and winning at all cost, Mr. Pugh said. Not easy for a guy like that not to show that he is trying to fulfill his promises, no matter how crazy they are. I am not so sure everything is just bullying and almost comic provocations, quote unquote. But how much can Trump actually achieve or damage? A news conference in Florida mixed vague threats. It might be that you'll have to do something with messianic promises. I'm talking about protecting the free world, Trump said. It was more than enough to awaken other nations, drawing rapt attention and resistance even before he took office. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. As many of you might be aware, a consortium of Republican financiers are fervently ambitious for democracy to be not only an autocracy, but also a moneyocracy, like fabled old Venice of medieval times, a real doged plutocracy. Have you yet become accustomed to 2025 without it sounding so much like an ancient Buck Rogers comic strip of a distant future, or perhaps a Star Trek fantasy of late 20th century TV? Beam me up, Scotty.